Support for NPR and the following message come from W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Hey, it's Guy here. So as you may have heard, there's a brand new host of the TED Radio Hour. Her name is Manoush Zomorodi, and she and the team are busy producing a bunch of new episodes, and you'll start to hear them beginning in March. In the meantime, I want to share some of my most favorite episodes of TED Radio Hour from the 7 years I hosted the show. And this one, it's all about the world of numbers and how math can answer some of life's most complicated questions, like, can we ever find love? Or why is this drumbeat so catchy? And how did tiny little Yoda lift that enormous X-wing out of the swamp in The Empire Strikes Back? This episode is called Solve for X. Enjoy. This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Back in 2009, this guy named Randall Monroe volunteered to teach a weekend class at MIT to a bunch of high school students.
They have a program where people can come in and teach classes on whatever subjects they're interested in, and a bunch of students come and sign up and take them. And I had some friends do classes on root beer tasting, and other ones do a class on, programming.
So Randall decided to teach the one subject he knew a little something about.
So I did a class on the physics of energy.
Because he'd studied physics in college. But on the first day of that class he was teaching, when he was giving his first lecture...
Well, I was talking about how you can define this quantity called potential energy, and you can calculate if you lift an object that weighs, 5 kilograms through a distance of 2 meters... then it will have about 95 or, 100 joules of potential energy.
This approach, of course, not a big hit with the kids.
The students got kind of bored, just like I always did in physics lectures.
And at that moment, it occurred to Randall that he was just throwing numbers at these kids that did not apply to anything in their world.
And it's just as abstract for me. I never run into a 5 kilogram weight in my life. I run into gallons of milk, or a cat might weigh 5 kilograms.
And then, standing in front of his class that day,
I realized that part of what makes math and science so exciting is having questions you want to answer.
So he thought, what kind of question would you want to answer if you're the kind of high school kid who signs up to take a class on the physics of energy on the weekend?
And at that point, I had a moment where I thought, wait a minute. The Empire Strikes Back.
Specifically? This question.
When Yoda lifts Luke's X-wing out of the swamp, how much energy did that take?
Use the Force.
Right, that scene where Luke's fighter plane is trapped in the water.
Mm-hmm. And it's a really straightforward calculation. If you can figure out the mass of the X-wing.
All right, I'll give it a try.
And how high he lifts it.
Try not. Do.
And
do not.
What the strength of gravity on Dagobah is.
There is no try.
And the students suddenly got really interested in figuring out, okay, how much does an X-Wing weigh? Is there a canonical value for the gravity on Dagobah? Like, oh, well, there's a Star Wars Wikipedia. We can look up the weight of the X-Wing then. Sure. They were suddenly, kind of running ahead of me and figuring things out before I could even get to them. And I realized, oh, this is the missing piece.
Size matters not. Look at me. Judge me by my size, do you?
Answering these interesting questions...
All right, it's time to embrace your inner nerd, because today on the show, we're solving for X. Stories and ideas about how numbers shape our world and our lives.
How people talk about themselves, how people interact with each other, how people present themselves when they're looking for a partner.
When I listen to other musicians, I say, man, he really sounds good when he does that. What is that?
How do we even get our heads around the algorithms that are used online when we create mathematical models of such complexity?
And most importantly, the question Randall Monroe asked that day in class. How do you make math interesting?
I think that a lot of the time, it's easy to get the impression that math is sort of supposed to be interesting for its own sake. But really, to me, what's exciting is the answers that the math can get you to. You know, I don't care what X is. Like, an equation doesn't mean anything until it's representing a real thing.
By the way, after crunching the numbers, Randall and his physics students eventually calculated that it took Yoda 19.2 kilowatts of energy to lift that X-wing fighter, or about what it takes to power a small tractor. Later in the show, Randall answers more questions that I promise have never occurred to you. But before we go any further trying to solve for X, a more basic question. What is X?
X is the unknown.
But why X? Why not another letter? Terry Moore wanted to find out.
Yes, exactly.
Terry directs an organization that promotes mathematics, and he told the story of why X is X on the TED stage.
About 6 years ago, I decided that I would learn Arabic, which turns out to be a supremely logical language. To write a word or a phrase or a sentence in Arabic is like crafting an equation because every part is extremely precise and carries a lot of information. That's one of the reasons so much of what we've come to think of as Western science and mathematics and engineering was really worked out in the first few centuries of the Common Era by the Persians and the Arabs and the Turks. This includes the little system in Arabic called algebra, and algebra roughly translates to the system for reconciling disparate parts. Algebra finally came into English as algebra. The Arabic texts containing this mathematical wisdom finally made their way to Europe, which is to say Spain, in the 11th and 12th century. And when they arrived, there was tremendous interest in translating this wisdom into a European language.
Okay, so they start translating algebra from Arabic into Spanish. So what's the unknown in Arabic? What's the X?
It was originally the word shay'un, which means something.
Something.
Something. Some undefined thing.
The problem for the medieval Spanish scholars who were tasked with translating this material is that the word shay'un can't be rendered into Spanish because Spanish doesn't have that SH, that sh sound. So by convention, they created a rule in which they borrowed the CK sound, the k sound, from the classical Greek in the form of the letter chi. Later, when this material was translated into a common European language, which is to say Latin, they simply replaced the Greek chi with the Latin X. And once that happened, once this material was in Latin, it formed the basis for mathematics textbooks for almost 600 years. But now we have the answer to our question. Why is it that X is the unknown? X is the unknown because you can't say sh in Spanish. And I thought that was worth sharing.
So this was kind of like a big misunderstanding, really. Like, it could have been Y or it could have been Q or B.
It's certainly possible. And to some degree, it was arbitrary. But the origin is that Arabic word shay'un, which means something. Had they chosen a different word, we probably would be referring to the unknown quantity by some other letter.
Yeah, what if X was B? Then everything would be B. We'd have like the B-men and Malcolm B, and B
That's
marks
right.
a spot in the B files.
That's right, and Project B.
It would ruin everything. Thank the gods it was the X.
Well, we're used to that now.
Do you like algebra?
Yes, I love algebra.
Why?
Because it's beautiful.
How? I keep hearing that. I hear mathematicians say it's beautiful, and then you like see these movies about these crazy geniuses and like scrawling on the chalkboards, and it is kind of nice actually. But I still don't get it.
I think that's a matter of temperament.
Huh.
There's some people to whom a mathematical proof appears as a thing of beauty. It speaks of a higher truth. It speaks of a harmony to knowledge. The fact that it works at all, let alone that we can understand it, speaks to a larger category of existence and knowledge.
Terry Moore. You can see his full talk, Why is X the Unknown, at ted.npr.org. So we're going to be hearing a lot of these drum beats throughout the show today. These drum beats are the work of Clayton Cameron.
I'm a provocateur of rhythm.
Clayton's drummed for a few musicians you might have heard of.
Including Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin.
As well as Sammy Davis Jr. and here with Tony Bennett.
Clayton Cameron!
Anyway, we asked Clayton to do some of the music on the show today and to talk about an idea from his TED Talk, an idea he calls...
Arithmetic.
Arithmetic. Basically, it's a way to understand how numbers and rhythm intersect. An idea that had never really occurred to Clayton until he moved next door to a mathematician.
And we were talking, and I'm no mathematician, okay, by any stretch of the imagination. However, he said something to me that I never forgot. He said, you know, those are really some beautiful numbers.
Like, and so said, were you just talking, like, about a beat or a song or something? And he's like, those are beautiful numbers.
Absolutely.
Huh.
And I said, wow. I said, if you're at a certain level with math, I guess they could be beautiful numbers. And then I had a conversation one day with a friend of mine who's an incredible drummer, musician named Marvin Smitty Smith. I said, Marvin, there's a track you do. I said, there's no way you could be thinking about this music the way I'm thinking about it because you make it seem so simple.
Huh.
And so Marvin said, well, I just think in cycles. And then he didn't have to say another word. I knew exactly what he meant. And so between numbers are beautiful and, you know, I just think in cycles from my friend Marvin, all these things started coming together.
So you started noticing, like, these cycles of numbers in the rhythms that you've been playing for years?
Absolutely. Now, watch this. I'm gonna play something, two different evenly spaced beats. One will be three and one will be two. So we have one, two, three, one, two, three. One, two, three, one, two, three. So I'm going to give you a different sound in my left hand. I'm going to play just two beats and within the same space of time. So we have one, two, one, two. It sounds like this together. Now watch what happens when I double it. This. I'm going to double it again.
Whoa.
It's the same ratio, and all I did was double the tempo.
It's the same pattern.
So when I break down these cycles and groupings of numbers and how they feel, I mean, three has a certain feel, a cycle of three, a cycle of five has a certain feel, a cycle of seven has a certain feel to it. And certain numbers in music emote a certain feeling.
Clayton Cameron. I'll be back later in the show with more hidden numbers in music. We're solving for X on the show today, uncovering how numbers shape our lives. More in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor HubSpot. More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Doing business has never felt harder. But you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You just need HubSpot. Because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: higher quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.
This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, we're solving for X, the hidden numbers that shape everything around us. Like, say, for example, when you flip through the radio dial. Take a number from
1 to 10. When I hear music these days, I wonder why I'm hearing this particular song. 1, 2, 3, 4,
get it! This is Kevin Slaven.
What it is in my behavior or the behavior of others or whatever produced this particular track at this particular time.
Kevin runs a research group at MIT that's obsessed with algorithms. And he thinks that we're now living in a sort of age of algorithms.
Our lives are made up of a series of decisions. What time does the train arrive and what's on the radio and what's happening to my retirement stock? And more of those decisions are made automatically by machines, increasingly without human supervision.
So here's an example from Kevin's life.
So yesterday I had to make my way from New York to Boston, so I needed to take a flight. And so I went online to one of the sites that just sort of lists, you know, what all the prices are. And what's the price of that ticket?
A chain of complex calculations figured out.
Routing, where the fuel depots are, projected seat fill, weather patterns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And once Kevin arrived in Boston, he decided,
I'm going to call for a car, and so I use Uber.
But then an algorithm decided,
what's that going to cost? Is it going to cost whatever it costs, or is it going to cost 1.2 times that? Is it going to cost 3.9 times that? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Then once he got home,
my wife and I are expecting a child,
oh,
so we were ordering.
Is this your first child?
It is, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We're sort of looking to see, okay, which crib?
And if you shop on Amazon, like Kevin does,
a lot of sellers on Amazon aren't actually setting the prices themselves. They're actually just using small algorithms that are looking at the prices of other cribs on there.
And that changes all the time.
Yeah, it changes many times in a second. So the price that we paid may never have been actually approved or even considered by a human at any point.
In fact, Kevin says you can find these kinds of things wherever you look. Here he is on the TED stage back in 2011.
And so Netflix has gone through several different algorithms over the years. They started with Cinematch, and they've tried a bunch of others. There's Dinosaur Planet, there's Gravity, they're using Pragmatic Chaos now. Pragmatic Chaos is, like all of Netflix algorithms, trying to do the same thing. It's trying to get a grasp on you, on the firmware inside the human skull, so that it can recommend what movie you might want to watch next, which is a very, very difficult problem. But the difficulty of the problem and the fact that we don't really quite have it down, it doesn't take away from the effects that Pragmatic Chaos has. Pragmatic Chaos, like all Netflix algorithms, determines, in the end, 60% of what movies end up being rented, right? So one piece of code with one idea about you is responsible for 60% of those movies. So if you need to have some image of what's happening in the stock market right now, what you can picture is a bunch of algorithms, and that's 70% of the United States stock market, 70% of the operating system formerly known as your pension, your mortgage. And what could go wrong?
A stunning and dramatic crash on Wall Street yesterday appears to be the
result. What could go wrong is that a year ago, 9% of the entire market just disappears.
In a matter of minutes.
Nearly 1,000-point drop.
And they called it the
flash crash.
Flash crash, which
flash
many
flash crash, as it was described.
Flash crash of 245.
The stocks go doop, boink.
All of a sudden, 9% just goes away.
You know, wait, look at it.
Look at it.
Just
look at it.
It's a fast market.
Yes.
It's a fast market.
The market was down 900 points.
We're
now down 688.
And nobody to this day can even agree on what happened. And that's the thing, right? This is that we're writing things. We're writing these things that we can no longer read. And it's we've rendered something kind of illegible. And we've lost the sense of what's actually happening in this world that we've made.
That's crazy.
It is crazy, right? And so one of the questions is, when we create mathematical models of such complexity And let's remember that any given algorithm within the stock market is impossibly complex, and then it is the interaction of all of these complex algorithms with one another. This is far beyond what any human could ever hope to understand, and it doesn't leave a forensic trail that provides an explanation. It just provides a bunch of data.
But you're saying that actually increasingly we're solving problems in a way that we don't really even understand.
That's exactly the point. I think that's one of the most important aspects of what's happening, and I think that characterizes our time.
So let me take it back to Wall Street, okay? Because the algorithms of Wall Street are dependent on one quality above all else, which is speed. And they operate on milliseconds and microseconds. And just to give you a sense of what microseconds are, it takes you 500,000 microseconds just to click a mouse. But if you're a Wall Street algorithm and you're 5 microseconds behind, you're a loser. So if you were an algorithm, you'd look for an architect like the one that I met in Frankfurt who was hollowing out a skyscraper, throwing out all the furniture, all the infrastructure for human use, and just running steel on the floors to get ready for the stacks of servers to go in, all so that an algorithm could get close to the internet. And you think of the internet as this kind of distributed system, and of course it is, but it's distributed from places, right? In New York, this is where it's distributed from. It's a Carrier Hotel located on Hudson Street. And this is really where the wires come right up into the city. And the reality is that the further away you are from that, you're a few microseconds behind. But if you zoom out, you would see an 825-mile trench between New York City and Chicago. It's been built over the last few years by a company called Spread Networks. This is a fiber optic cable that was laid between those two cities to just be able to traffic one signal 37 times faster than you can click a mouse, just for these algorithms. And when you think about this, that we're running through the United States with dynamite and rock saws so that an algorithm can close the deal 3 microseconds faster, all for a communications framework that no human will ever know, that's a kind of manifest destiny, and we'll always look for a new frontier.
So basically, you could argue that our lives are controlled by algorithms.
I think it's more, the word that I use is shaped. The rough edges of what determines our sense of the day are, in fact, sort of hinted by these mathematical models that are all around us. You know, there's still an awful lot of things that happen in the world that can't nobody predict and probably won't ever be able to. And I think that's great and that's fine. I just think that those unpredictable elements have this weird kind of frisson with an increasingly predictable set of models that are sort of at every level of our lives.
So there's a limit to all this.
Yeah, and that maybe so there is a limit, but I think it's also it's not just that there's a humility in being reminded that there's a limit. There's also a value in realizing that there's a limit. I think that it's a reasonable dream to have that we can take a fundamentally mathematical model to everything in the world and then just solve all the problems in it. But it's also fundamentally impossible. And I think that there's a great value in recognizing the idea of striving towards something impossible, but also the impossibility of the task.
Kevin Slavin runs the Playful Systems Group at the MIT Media Lab. Check out his talk at ted.npr.org. Earlier in the show, we met Randall Monroe. He has a physics background, but he now mainly writes and illustrates a really popular webcomic. It's called What If? And the way it works is every week, people write in questions for Randall to answer in the form of a comic. So, for example, what if you were playing baseball, right? And you were the batter. What would happen if the pitcher threw the baseball impossibly fast, like 90% the speed of light? Here's Randall's answer.
So I did some calculations.
From the TED stage.
Now, normally when an object flies through the air will flow around the object. But in this case, the ball would be going so fast that the air molecules wouldn't have time to move out of the way. The ball would smash right into and through them. And the collisions with these air molecules would knock away the nitrogen and carbon and hydrogen from the ball, fragmenting it off into tiny particles, triggering waves of thermonuclear fusion in the air around it. This would result in a flood of X-rays that would spread out in a bubble along with exotic particles centered on the pitcher's mound. Now, at this point, about 30 nanoseconds in, the home plate is far enough away that light hasn't had time to reach it, which means the batter still sees the pitcher about to throw and has no idea that anything is wrong. Now, after 70 nanoseconds, the ball will reach home plate, or at least the cloud of expanding plasma that used to be the ball. And it will engulf the bat, and the batter, and the plate, and the catcher, and the umpire, and start disintegrating them all, followed by a blast wave spreading out, shredding trees and houses as it moves away from the stadium, and then eventually a mushroom cloud rising up over the ruined city. So the Major League Baseball rules are a little bit hazy, but under rules 6.02 and 5.09, I think that in this situation, the batter would be considered hit by pitch and would be eligible to take first base if it still existed.
This is the kind of question Randall answers every week in his webcomic, What If? Questions like, how fast could you visit all 50 states? Or how long would a staircase to space take to climb? Or what would happen if all the rain in a thunderstorm dropped at once in the form of a single raindrop? Short answer there, nothing good.
In the case of the raindrop that's this big and falling this fast, when the bottom hits, there's so much more water coming, and it's coming so quickly that there isn't enough time for the first part of the splash to get out of the way before the next part of the raindrop is already there. And this causes a thin jet to shoot outward along the ground, away from the point of contact, and in all directions. You'll get these jets of water moving at, much higher than the speed of sound. Yeah, you would want to watch this from a safe distance away.
Like from a mountaintop.
Make sure to have a mountaintop. And even if you've got a mountain between you and the raindrop, you'd want to make sure you are not downstream of that raindrop.
How do you think you approach something unknown differently than other people do?
Well, I have always had a little bit of trouble managing my time and just clicking random Wikipedia links or reading random papers. And then before I know it, I've spent like 3 hours trying to solve a question that I'm not even going to write an article about. And I once drew a comic about how you could sort of use this maliciously, this tendency science people have, where I had a comic about someone who sat outside an engineering building by the side of the road. And when the physics professor was halfway across the road, they would hold up a sign with an interesting problem on it. And the physics professor would stop immediately and start thinking about, okay, how do I solve this? Take the square root of, and then wham, they'd get hit by a car. And so I invented this sport that I called nerd sniping. But part of what I did with my idea with What If is that I'm nerd sniping myself. I'm getting all these questions sent to me that then I will have no choice but to try to answer.
Like a couple of years ago, when he got the following question. Say all the world's known data were stored on punch cards. You know, those paper cards with holes that used to be fed into giant computers?
A card punch translates words and numbers into the same information in the form of holes in cards. A typist with very little extra training can operate the card punch.
Anyway, the question was, if we still store data that way, how much physical space would Google need to store all the data that Google has? Google, of course, wasn't going to tell Randall how much data they do have. So Randall came up with an answer he thought was plausible.
I came up with my estimate, which I felt pretty good about, that was about 10 exabytes of data across all of Google's operations. And then another maybe 5 exabytes or so of offline storage in like tape drives, which it turns out Google is about the world's largest consumer of. So I came up with this estimate, and this is a staggering amount of data. It's quite a bit more than any other organization in the world has, as far as we know. There's a couple other contenders, especially the everyone always thinks of the NSA. Adding all of this up, I came up with the other thing that we can answer, which is, how many punch cards would this take? And so a punch card can hold about 80 characters, and you can fit about, you know, 2,000 or so cards into a box. And you put them in, say, my home region of New England, it would cover the entire region up to a depth of a little less than 5 kilometers, which is about 3 times deeper than the glaciers during the last ice age, about 20,000 years ago. So this is impractical, but I didn't expect to get an answer from Google. Because, of course, they've been so secretive, they didn't answer any of my questions. And so I just put it up and said, well, I guess we'll never know. But then a little while later, I got a message a couple weeks later from Google saying, hey, someone here has an envelope for you. So I go and get it, open it up, and it's punch cards. Google-branded punch cards. And on these punch cards, there are a bunch of holes. You know, and I said, thank you. And then I was, okay, so what's on here? So I get some software and start reading it and scan them, and it turns out it's a puzzle. There's a bunch of code. And I get some friends to help, and we crack the code, and then inside that is another code, and then there are some equations, and then we solve those equations, and then finally, and out pops a message from Google, which is their official answer to my article. And it said, no comment. So, and I love calculating these kinds of things. And it's not that I love doing the math. I do a lot of math, but I don't really like math for its own sake. What I love is that it lets you take some things that you know, and just by doing these, moving symbols around on a piece of paper, find out something that you didn't know that's very surprising. And I have a lot of stupid questions, and I love that math gives the power to answer them sometimes. And sometimes not. This is a question I got from a reader, an anonymous reader, and the subject line just said urgent, and this was the entire email. If people had wheels and could fly, how would we differentiate them from airplanes? Urgent. And I think there are some questions that math just cannot answer. Thank you.
Randall Monroe, his talk is at TED.com, and his webcomic is at XKCD.com. On the show today, we're solving for X, how numbers shape the world. Next up, how one equation might help you find true love.
W at T plus 1 equals little w plus RWWT plus IHM brackets HT. But this only maximizes your chances of finding the perfect person for you. It doesn't guarantee it.
I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, the automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy explains how Betterment's technology helps investors better understand and save on taxes.
So taxes are a real cost of investing, as are fees. Understanding your after-tax, after-fee returns is really what's important for investors. An example would be when you buy and sell securities frequently, you can pay a lot of taxes because short-term capital gains, meaning I bought it and I sold it fairly quickly, have higher taxes than long-term capital gains. Our technology in particular will tell you what the tax implication of a particular move you'd like to make is going to be before you make that move so that you're making it with full transparency.
Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, we're solving for X, stories and ideas about how numbers shape our world. You remember Clayton Cameron, right?
Hello, hello, hello.
Clayton, big-time jazz drummer, popping in and out of the show today to explain ideas from his TED Talk about how math and rhythm intersect.
Yeah, it seems, you know, just from the surface, if you said, you know, math and music, that, oh, well, that wouldn't swing or groove. Or,
yeah, math is not groovy or swinging.
Yeah, but, you know, when I listen to other musicians, I say, man, he really sounds good when he does that. You know, what is that? Now, I can listen to Phil Collins, Max Roach. I can listen to Tony Williams. These are all drummers, famous drummers. Yeah. Elvin Jones and all these. In each of their styles of playing, they're going to play different threes.
Threes?
Absolutely. You know, like the classic rock beat, a rock fill. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, boom, boom, bam. So that's a group of three that fill. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, boom, bam. Well, Max Roach, father of bebop drumming, along with another drummer by the name of Kenny Clarke, they introduced syncopation into the music like it never had been used before. And so Max used to do this thing where he would, between his left hand and his bass drum and his cymbal, it would go do da da do da da do da da do da do da da do da da do da da do da do da da do da da do da da do da. And so what you're hearing is 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 do 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 da da do da da do da da do da. You know, in the move, da ba do da dee ba do le da do ba, a do ba da zum dee da do le da do da. So all those things have the groupings of three. It's three is like a magic number. It's like, I don't know what the explanation is. Three just feels great.
Clayton Cameron, he'll be back later. This episode, we're solving for X, ideas about math, or as our friends in the UK might say,
maths.
Let's talk about this for a sec. Why do you guys say maths?
Well, this is like a massive issue.
It's a big issue.
People get really properly angry about it. There is a kind of joke in the UK where people say math and then someone just goes, shh.
This is Hannah Fry. She's a mathematician.
As far as I'm concerned, I struggle to find anything in the world that you can't get an interesting perspective on by using maths.
Including perhaps the most mysterious, inexplicable part of life, which is, of course, love. You think that there's a connection between math and love? Like it can explain love in part?
Well, so the thing is that in people's love lives, as in all of life, there are certain patterns in the way that people behave. And math is perfectly placed to be able to take those patterns and translate them and then give them back to you with a little bit of insight wrapped up.
That's so romantic.
All right. Good point.
Hannah's written about this in a book. It's called The Mathematics of Love. And it's full of lessons about how numbers can actually help us find love, including
how to win at online dating.
Here's Hannah's TED Talk.
Okay. So my favorite online dating website is OkCupid, not least because it was started by a group of mathematicians. Now, because they're mathematicians, they have been collecting data on everybody who uses their site for almost a decade, and they've been trying to search for patterns in the way that we talk about ourselves and the way that we interact with each other on an online dating website. And they've come up with some seriously interesting findings. But my particular favorite is that it turns out that on an online dating website, how attractive you are does not dictate how popular you are. Let me show you how this works. Okay, so in a thankfully voluntary section of OkCupid, you are allowed to rate how attractive you think people are on a scale between 1 and 5. Now, if we compare this score, the average score, to how many messages a selection of people receive, you can begin to get a sense of how attractiveness links to popularity on an online dating website. And the important thing to notice is that it's not totally true that the more attractive you are, the more messages you get. But the question arises then of what is it about people up here who are so much more popular than people down here, even though they have the same score of attractiveness?
And the idea is that if you're looking through people's profiles on OkCupid and you find someone and they're super, super beautiful, in your head, you're thinking, they probably get loads of messages. There's not really much point in me humiliating myself by sending them a message. They're never going to reply. And you move on to the next profile. But then you see someone and you think they're really beautiful, but you also think that perhaps not everyone is going to think that they're beautiful. So maybe they've got loads of tattoos or, you know, crazy colored hair or whatever. In that way, it's sort of less competition for you and it's an extra incentive for you to get in touch.
Okay, all right, so if you want to get like more attention and like more messages to you, you want to play up the things that make you like a little weird or different, right?
Yeah, because the people who like you anyway are still going to like you, and the people who don't only serve to your advantage.
So in some ways, you could argue that mathematicians are like have an unfair advantage when it comes to online dating.
Yeah, I mean, mathematicians famously brilliant at finding lovers.
Are they really?
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah.
Really? Who knew?
I'm joking. I'm so joking.
So let's imagine then that you're a roaring success on the dating scene. But the question arises of how do you then convert that success into longer-term happiness? And in particular, how do you decide when is the right time to settle down? Now, generally, it's not advisable to just cash in and marry the first person who comes along and shows you any interest at all. But equally, you don't really want to leave it too long if you want to maximise your chance of long-term happiness. So the question is then, how do you know when is the right time to settle down, given all the people that you could date in your lifetime? Now, thankfully, there's a rather delicious bit of mathematics that we can use to help us out here called optimal stopping theory. Okay, so let's imagine then that you start dating when you're 15, and ideally, you'd like to be married by the time that you're 35. And there's a number of people that you could potentially date across your lifetime, and they'll be at kind of varying levels of goodness. Now, the rules are that once you cash in and get married, you can't look ahead to see what you could have had. And equally, you can't go back and change your mind. Okay, so the math says then that what you should do in the first 37% of your dating window, you should just reject everybody as serious marriage potential. And then you should pick the next person that comes along that is better than everybody that you've seen before.
Hannah says using this idea from math, it's called optimal stopping theory, can dramatically increase your odds of finding the perfect partner. So say you dated like 20 people in your life. Well, if you just picked one of those 20 people at random to marry, there's a 5% chance you'd have found your perfect partner.
Which is like not very good odds, really.
But if you dated the same 20 people and you flat out rejected the first third,
you then can up your chances of finding the perfect person to almost 40%.
Wow.
So from going from 1 in 20 to more than a third, you've just massively changed your chances of finding them.
But this is all a matter of probability. I mean, there's a chance you could reject your soulmate in that 37% window.
Yeah. I mean, there are risks involved, right? Mm. So your perfect person could come along in your rejection phase and you could get rid of them and then spend the rest of your life regretting the fact that you didn't just marry them. This only maximizes your chances of finding the perfect person for you. It doesn't guarantee it.
Ah, math.
Yeah, damn it.
It ruins everything.
I think it makes everything brilliant.
Okay, so let's say you've made it through your rejection phase. You found that perfect person within your 37% window. How do you know if it's going to last?
And that's something that it turns out you can write a really beautifully simple set of equations to look at.
Beautifully simple if you're a mathematician.
So the equation is W at T plus 1 equals little w plus RWWT plus IHM brackets HT.
Mathematicians came up with this equation for love by studying how couples argue. A group of psychologists spent years filming couples having conversations.
And they asked them, for 15 minutes or so, I want you to talk about the most contentious issue in your relationship.
Things like who does what around the house, working late, missing important events, money, in-laws. And during those conversations, the researchers monitored the couple's heart rates, their facial expressions, how much they were sweating.
And they worked out a way to give them scores, so positive or negative scores, based on everything that happened in their interaction.
And then those numbers, they got plugged into the set of equations Hannah just mentioned.
We call it a coupled set of equations, because you have one equation for the husband and one equation for the wife.
So for the wife, better known as
WT plus one,
how she will handle talking about a contentious issue with her husband is based on
her general mood, little w, plus her general mood when she's with her husband, RWWT, plus how she reacts to the last thing that her husband says in that exact conversation, IHM brackets HT.
With this information and a lot of calculations,
they could predict whether or not people were going to get divorced with a 90% accuracy.
Wow. How do you know?
So there's a few things that are really big indicators, and these are patterns that only come out once you look at this mathematically. It's not just about, because every couple argue, right? Every couple are a little bit negative to each other at some point. But it's about how that negativity can spiral into something really out of control and about how likely that is to happen.
But the really important term in this equation is the influence that people have on one another, and in particular, something called the negativity threshold. Now, the negativity threshold, you can think of as how annoying the husband can be before the wife starts to get really pissed off, basically, and vice versa. Now, I always thought that good marriages were about compromise and understanding and allowing the person to have space to be themselves. So I would have thought that perhaps the most successful relationships were ones where there was a really high negativity threshold, where couples let things go and only brought things up if they really were a big deal. But actually, the mathematics and subsequent findings by the team have shown that the exact opposite is true. The best couples or the most successful couples are the ones with a really low negativity threshold. These are the couples that don't let anything go unnoticed and allow each other some room to complain. These are the couples that are continually trying to repair their own relationship, that have a much more positive outlook on their marriage. Couples that don't let things go, and couples that don't let trivial things end up being a really big deal. It's quite interesting to know that there is really mathematical evidence to say that you should never let the sun go down on your anger.
This is very reassuring to know. It's pretty cool that, you know, with an equation, you can just predict if you're destined for a life of bliss.
Well, maybe that's not quite true. It's more like these equations give us a language to be able to talk about conflict in long-term relationships in a way that you can't do if you just think really qualitatively.
Yeah, I mean, most people don't think of math as a language, right?
No, I know, and it just absolutely is. So Galileo says that, talks about the universe as though it's a book that's been written by God, and everything in the universe is contained within this book. And then he says that the language of that book has to be mathematics. And it's just absolutely true. You can just describe everything around you, everything in the human world, everything in the natural world, everything in the physical world. At some level, you can use maths to describe it.
Hannah Fry, her TED book about this is called The Mathematics of Love. You can find out more about the book and see Hannah's full talk at TED.com. Finally this hour, that idea from Galileo that math is a language? Well, it doesn't really matter whether you're a mathematician or a musician.
Knowing the language, now I feel like my vocabulary increased.
Huh.
And so therefore, I'm able to communicate my ideas even better.
Drummer Clayton Cameron, he says studying math actually gave him a new confidence in how he played music.
And I'm going to share a story just about my confidence in sitting down, knowing that if I do a certain thing, it's going to emote a certain feeling,
yeah,
if done right. So I'm playing at the Hollywood Bowl with James Brown, and I've been told that by the musical director, Christian Bride, he said, look, you know, Clayton, James is a drummer, you know, Mr. Brown's a drummer, and, you know, he created this genre of music. So the chances are he may not like anything you play. And I said, well, you know, I'm a professional. I've been around, and I understand that. So I talked to a couple of drummers, friends of mine that had played with James, just to get some insight. Listen to the record that James Brown had done. It was a jazz record called Soul on Top, 1969. But he never performed any of them. So there was one song called September Song that had a boogaloo beat.
Oh, it's a long time.
That was kind of like what was happening at the time when jazz guys would sit down. So I said, well, you know, I'm gonna bring it up a little bit. I'm gonna kind of do a little different beat on it. And I had, you know, put a special snare up, and then I worked on this little groove. So that was the groove. So we get to the rehearsal, we're playing, and Kristen McBride calls off the song. And James Brown has the pickup. And the lyric is,
oh, it's a long time.
And then we're into the groove. I'm into my groove.
May to December.
Now remember, it's been told to me, it's been embedded in my head, that James Brown is not going to like anything you play.
Yeah.
After we played that groove, James Brown turned around and said, now that was funky.
How?
You know, so anyway, so that kind of stuff, you know, once you get into the numbers and you understand, that gave me the confidence to sit down and go, oh, I know what that is. The numbers are there.
Clayton Cameron, you can watch his talk at TED.com.
Because it's a mother. When I count to four, I want everybody to lay out, let the drummer go. And when I count to four, I want you to come back in. One, two, three, four, get it!
Hey, thanks for listening to our show this week, Solving for X, How Numbers Shape the World. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Chris Benderev, with help from Daniel Shukin. Barton Girdwood is our intern. In the front office, Eric Newsom and Portia Robertson-Migas. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The name of the tune is The Funky Drummer. The Funky Drummer. The Funky Drummer. The Funky Drummer. The Funky Drummer.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing. Visit your local REI co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways to opt outside.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.